on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
We're using words right now to describe these, you know, processes going on in our mind and body. And, you know, we're constantly closing the aperture and only putting in, you know, reflecting a small amount of light compared to what's really around us all the time. And I think Wilson's work is dedicated to just, you know, widening the aperture. And it's not, you know, blow the lens up and, you know, throw a bomb at it and blow the lens up and let all the light in, man, like the Joker and chaos and wild right. and crazy. No, Wilson's work is like, he's like a sensei. It's a measured, you know, sort of belt by belt, you know, initiation system, if you will, if you approach it like this. And
welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by author Gabriel Kennedy, a.k.a. Propanon, to discuss his book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. We delve into the life and work of Wilson, who is perhaps best known for his Illuminatus trilogy. Gabriel explains Wilson's influence on counterculture, his philosophy of model agnosticism, and his optimistic outlook despite personal and professional challenges. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Gabriel Kennedy, also known as Prop Anon, is a multimedia artist concentrating on the written word, visual art, and music. His work has appeared in boingboing.net, mondo2000.com, thetonearm.com, and on his own websites, chapelperilous.us and propanon.com. He first interviewed Robert Anton Wilson in 2003 and was an original member of Wilson's online learning website, the Maybe Logic Academy. He joins me today to discuss Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, his first book. Gabriel, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me here today.
Well, I am incredibly excited to have you here today. I have been a fan of Robert Anton Wilson for quite a long time, and he's been something of an influence on my own thought, I think, in many ways. I finished reading your book last evening, and I found it to be quite incredible. It was, I think it fills a void. I think this is the first biography of Wilson. And I'm going to be honest with you, I kind of teared up at the end. I found it very moving, and it just brought up a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm looking forward to this. So I thought that the place to begin would be, I don't want to assume that everyone who is listening or watching this knows who Robert Anton Wilson is. So if you were at a party and you just said, you know, someone's like, oh, what do you do? And you said, well, I just wrote a book on Robert Anton Wilson. And they asked, well, who was that? How would you answer that question? Who was Robert Anton Wilson?
I just tell him he's the most influential American writer that you've probably never heard of.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to me that he would like that definition too, maybe. But why, in what ways was he influential?
Well, yeah. Well, Wilson's influence, you know, sort of permeates through the, you know, from the counterculture to now sort of mainstream culture very quietly. You know, he's sort of most known for people who kind of know him at a certain, you know, level as the guy who wrote about the Illuminati, if you will. Mm-hmm. And just like the Illuminati, he's, you know, it's kind of people don't really know much about him, you know. Mm-hmm. But if we, you know, just sort of look at his life and see that here was a writer born in, you know, America during the Great Depression and lived through all these different stages of American culture and this rapid increase of technological development in the 20th century. Wilson was an artist that was really making sense of the world as it was happening in a lot of ways. And in doing that, he was anticipating what was coming down the pike for the rest of us. So, for instance, a book that he wrote 50 years ago is extremely relevant today. So, Yeah, you know, Wilson was an American writer, a, you know, novelist, nonfiction writer. You know, he wrote over 30 books in a 40-plus year career. He published his first piece in 1959 in Paul Krasner's sort of pioneering underground American newspaper, The Realist. And he wrote until his near dying day in 2007. And throughout the course of that time, he's probably, as I said, most well known as the Illuminati guy, if you will, or the Illuminatus guy, because of the book that he and his friend and co-author Robert Shea wrote, Trilogy, which is an 800 plus page, you know, roller coaster ride through history. And as someone called it one time, you know, the Bible for paranoids. And, you know, and then of course he went on, that was his first published book. And then he went on to have a, you know, really amazing career without getting much attention again, like his, you know, compadres, if you will, people like Timothy Leary or William S. Burroughs or many other people that Bob knew who were, you know, famous, if you will. And Wilson's influence was, as I said, sort of a quiet one. You know, many people read him, loved him, took the ideas that he wrote about and then quickly folded it into their own work and received a lot of great attention for the great work that they've done. So, you know, as I said, Wilson is the most important American writer that you've probably never heard of, because in his nonfiction, you know, he really does act as a sort of early warning radar system most of the time. He, you know, he's a futurist in terms of thinking about what was going to happen. And, but his own unique way of looking at the world and his own brand of what I basically would call process philosophy really, I think, is important for today, because we're at this time where there's so much flux and seeming dissolution and chaos. Why not read the guy who, you know, reminds us that, you know, there's a goddess of chaos and her name is Eris.
Right. And there's a counterpart too, which is the symbolic, I think, like the pentagram or pentagon, excuse me, and that's order. And you've got these two sort of forces at play. And he seemed to relish the chaotic aspect to things, it seems to me. I wanted to, before we get into some of the books and some of his ideas, I was curious, when did you first encounter his work?
I first saw Illuminatus Trilogy in the back of math class senior year of high school. I think it wasn't calculus. Yeah, I flunked out of calculus at that time, so I don't quite remember. I think, what was it? Like Algebra 2 or something? I'm not quite sure. I didn't pay much attention to the math class at the time, but I paid attention to this book. And, you know, a buddy of mine showed me, you know, again, this 800 page book, and I saw the cover, and, you know, I looked at the back flap and the, you know, the description of the book about this secret society called the Illuminati that runs the world in, you know, the dark of night. And I thought this was absurd. How could there be one group that, you know, runs all these people in the world? That sounds crazy to me. Yet there was something about it that, like, you know, the book was magically charged. It was, I've never encountered a book like this. You know, I kind of opened the front page and I heard like the some movie sound effect of like a rising ta-ha, and like, you know, golden light shone out of the pages, like, you know, Pulp Fiction when they open the briefcase. But, you know, and then I read the first quote of the book, and that's really what got me, you know, because when I read the back quote, it just seemed like a cool detective novel, pretty much, you know. And but then the first quote that Wilson and Shea use is a quote from the writer Ishmael Reed in his book Mumbo Jumbo. And I believe, you know, off the top of my head, the quote is like, you know, the history of the world is the history of warfare between secret societies, plural. So that rang more true to me than one group, right? And so having not knowing many things about secret groups or whatever and whatnot, but it obviously something doesn't seem to click to what you're told as, you know, happening in the world and what you see with your eyes in some ways. I believe in the 60s, they called that the credibility gap between what the media was telling people, what was going on in Vietnam, and what people were really seeing on the news. You know, when you're a kid, you're very aware of the credibility gaps all around you, you know, the hypocrisy of, you know, things that you're told, you know.
Right.
So this book was sort of like that answer to that sort of a youthful cynicism of like, yeah, man, I know there's some bull going around,
yeah.
you know, like, and it was just so well written in my eyes. It was experimental and kind of hard to follow at first, but then that's what made it really fun to then the way that Wilson and Shea write that book. It's, you know, the way they like transition from scene to scene, it's very abrupt sometimes. And it's, you know, right in the middle of a sentence or whatnot. It's sort of like flipping at the time. I was like flipping channels, you know, on a TV, but now it's sort of like going from one open window to another on your computer. Right. Meaning the way that Wilson was able to write novels was really conscious and aware of how media works. You know, he was able to utilize words, not on a page, not in the most basic narrative way, but he was always experimenting. So I appreciated that about Illuminatus. So long story short, I mean, I've read that book over the summer and it just completely captured my imagination, captured all my attention. You know, highs and lows completely frightened me, having gone to Catholic school for most of my life at that time and reading about the great old ones, the Cthulhu, you know, the Yog-Sothoth, these ancient right. gods that don't give a damn about you or me. And we're just fleas to be flicked away whenever they feel like right. it. This frightened me. I remember like having a sit down with a friend of mine at the time, like, yo, I'm reading this book, man. This is like really messing me up, you know? And he was like, that sounds messed up. But that's what that book is for, you know? That's what this yeah. great sort of literature is for, like a Philip K. Dick book or, you know, like, the Illuminatus trilogy. They go so well together. They really capture something. They capture your attention. And based off the strength of that book, you know, some time elapsed, maybe about a year, but... And then I read Cosmic Trigger Volume 1 and Prometheus Rising probably over the next summer. And those were Wilson's nonfiction works that sort of explored, you know, Prometheus Rising explores this kind of psychological outlook you can have towards the world, which I found very optimistic and positive and inspiring and really helpful at that time in my life. And then Cosmic Trigger Volume 1 was just... really like it was like, you know, I was reading like Norman Mailer and Hunter S. Thompson at the time. And to me, it fit right in. It was this new journalism, but like yeah. this new journalism with this heart that none of them had. Norman Mailer, Thomas Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson, none of them wrote with this heart that Wilson wrote with, you know, yeah. especially when he's talking about the death of his daughter, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, Wilson just became my favorite writer from that point on. You know, And I was reading a lot of William S. Burroughs at the time as well and getting into his, you know, cut up method notions and then learning that Burroughs had studied with Alfred Korzybski at Harvard and Wilson was super into Alfred Korzybski, who is the author or, you know, it started this thing called General Semantics and he was a major influence on Wilson. So I just became, again, he became my favorite writer, you know, so
yeah.
from that point on.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to think about when I first came across Wilson and I think it was Illuminatus and it was at a bookstore and I would go into the bookstore and for some reason that book kept calling to me. And so eventually I'm like, okay, and I knew nothing about him. I didn't know anyone who had read it. And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to buy the book. And I remember taking it up and the sales clerk, they kind of look at me and they were like, this is a really good book, man.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's how it seems the transmission really got passed like that, like for that yeah. book more than any other book that I've ever encountered, really, that the word of mouth, you know, advertising, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have no idea if I had, you know, I don't remember if I had heard of Wilson before. I've read Burroughs and, you know, it's this interesting kind of ocean of influences, you know, that all kind of merge and mix together. That's also kind of on the fringes of things. Mm-hmm. So I always find that really interesting. In terms of, let's look at a little bit, because he's written a lot of books and we don't want to go into all of them. And I don't want to go into every single detail of his life. We want people to read your book, but I'm not sure where to start. Let's start maybe since we started talking about Illuminatus and the Illuminati, why don't we start there? I know that the Illuminati was a real organization And I, even when I was doing my doctoral work, I was reading the letters and the writings of Thomas Jefferson, and I was very surprised to see him mention the Bavarian Illuminati. And I think if I understand correctly, though, Wilson, you know, it's not that he took the approach that this was this organization that was behind everything. They, at some point, they also started kind of playing around with it and saying, like, sending letters to various folks suggesting that what was behind this was the Bavarian Illuminati. Am I on the right track there? Is that what they
yes.
did?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, they would definitely, you know, when Wilson and his friends came along, what they did with the trope, if you will, of the Illuminati was they subverted the way that it was being thought about in the culture up until that time, if you will. The Bavarian Illuminati was, you know, as far as we know, right, a short-lived organization. It was a secret society that was started in 1776 by a theologian, I suppose, a man named Adam Weishaupt in Bavaria, Germany now. I guess it was Germany then as well. But and he recruited from, you know, the top ranks of, you know, Freemasons, and in that secret group, they spoke of, some say plotted, to, you know, world revolution and whatnot. And from their writings, their revolution mostly seemed to entail, you know, an increase in individual rights, a decrease of authoritarian power of the church, moving on from, you know, monarchies, you know, and sort of maybe, you know, presaging, you know, the hopes for democracies and whatnot, you know. So, but since that time, they were, in 1783, I believe, they were disbanded by the, you know, local ruler, if you will, of Bavaria. And the theories began nearly immediately, or number, maybe a decade later, like after the French Revolution. There's two writers that write about the influence that the Illuminati, the Bavarian Illuminati, had on the French Revolution. This guy named John Robinson, and then this dude, Abbé Barul. These are the two writers. I might have mispronounced their names. One of them, you know, kind of presented this sort of like a smaller scale influence that the Illuminati may have had on the revolution. That could have been Robinson, and that was that. But then Barul, I think, presents the sort of first jumbo, you know, grand narrative conspiracy theory about the Illuminati, that they went underground and they had, you know, direct influence on the French Revolution. And then, you know, they're not trying to bring democracy, but more so this new level of strange control and whatnot. But it just so happened that, to, you know, really contextualize this, like, Barul was part of the class that just got ousted in the French Revolution. In other words, he wasn't very happy about this. And so he needed, you know, an ultra scapegoat. And who could that be? Oh, the shadowy secret organization called the Illuminati that, you know. So the Illuminati becomes, you know, it's now a mimetic entity, if you will, right? It exists in the minds of people's imagination as much as it existed in history now. I believe it was Barul then who adds another layer of the theory that the Illuminati was directly related to the Knights Templar, which was a 14th century group, right? That was, you know, where they were disbanded in the 14th century. And so here you have this, you know, now a longer, the story that, you know, this is how conspiracy theories grow life, you know. And so just through the years, we'll just fast forward, say, to, you know, a woman named Nesta Webster, you know, people like that during the early 1900s or whatever. The Illuminati gets invoked in this. She's sort of like this original sort of Mae Brussels, sort of like a, you know, she's letting people know what's going on in the world. She creates this world chart, right? And the Illuminati is a major part of it. And then as the, this is really going fast through the story, right? Mm-hmm. When the 1950s comes along, right? Like fast forwarding many, many years, the Illuminati is sort of existing in this, you know, right wing conspiracy theory echo chamber, if you will, that's epitomized by this group called the John Birch Society, which is this kind of anti-communist organization founded in the name of this soldier who died in World War II. It's not even the guy who, I don't know where, right? Started by this guy named Robert Welch, I believe, but it's named after John Birch. But they, for them, the Illuminati were now, they're, you know, basically like Satanists who were, you know, somehow an anti-Semitic wave gets brought into all of this too. And it just becomes a very sort of like a receptacle of a lot of like projective dark thoughts about others or whatever, you know, that's my take on it. So people like Wilson at the time, they saw this as sort of a paranoid style. Like this was not the way to think about history. This is, you know, the conspiracy view of history doesn't really get you anywhere. You know, it's just a substitute for, you know, blaming the gods on Mount Olympus for your troubles or whatever, you know? So when he writes Illuminatus Trilogy, he's poking fun at the idea of the Illuminati, but Wilson and Shea, of course, being gifted literary minds, they were raised in a generation that really took books seriously. They're great writers. So they want you to believe in the Illuminati when you're reading this thing. And they're constantly switching it, right? Is the Illuminati real? Yes, it's real. No, wait, the Illuminati's not real. And, you know, the central plot of this 800-page book, Illuminatus Trilogy, is just a, you know, thousands-plus-year war between the Discordians and the Illuminati that is all coming to a head on May 1st, 1976 in Ingolstadt, Germany, at a rock concert where, you know, the Illuminati is now manifested as a rock band, and they're going to hypnotize the whole crowd and let Yog-Sothoth and a bunch of reanimated Nazis from the sea kill all of them for their life energy and feed their demonic ways. But little do they know, the Discordians are headed by the last Illuminatus, Hagbard Chalene, who taps into the goddess Eris, and the Discordians come in and save the day, etc., etc. And so within that book, there's just such a nice, great unpacking and discussion of, well, what is this group, the Illuminati? And then if you really read it, I think carefully, there's also the other line of questioning of like, why do we even think like this? Why do we even think that there's, you know, if you will, why do we create conspiracy theories? But then also, how do you know? There are obviously conspiracies that go on in the world and, you know, behind the closed doors. So what do you do then?
Right. Yeah. That's one of the things I really appreciate about Wilson is this. He's very non-dogmatic about things and looks at everything from many different perspectives. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was last summer I was at a retreat. And I'd been on this, I don't know, I was talking to some people and I'd been on this Prince kick. When I go to the gym, I listen to a lot of Prince. I've got way more Prince on my music player than I should have. But I mentioned Prince and this guy, he's like, dude, you know, the Illuminati killed him. And I was like, I'm pretty sure it was the fentanyl. But I just found it so amazing that we still have this idea that the Illuminati is still this like devious force in the imagination. And yet we also have all these other conspiracy theories that just won't go away. And you see similarities to so many of them. And I began wondering, you know, what would Wilson have to say about the situation we're in today? We don't hear a lot about, for example, QAnon anymore, but that was a major conspiracy theory for a while.
Oh, big time, big time. Yeah. I mean, you know, it is interesting that the seduction of to blame this thing called the Illuminati on, you know, there's triangles in the picture, man. That's Illuminati. Yep. You know, triangles, an Illuminati symbol. You know, so It is the Illuminati mythos, you know, is really sort of like the original conspiracy theory of the modern world, really, you know, and where it's solidified, right? You know, that's because before this, you know, when you look at it, essentially, who killed Prince? Well, that's the Illuminati. So it's okay. I have someone to blame. It's them. Yeah. So the Illuminati is a scapegoat. It's a shadowy, anonymous figure that you could blame and point a finger at and somehow feel better about yourself doing it. But the deeper, you know, level to all this is the fact that we're scapegoating to begin with. And Wilson really looks at this throughout, you know, most of his works, but, you know, some more than others. And that's, you know, the core of why he uses conspiracy theories in especially say in Illuminatus, or why he examines conspiracy theories, like in the book, Everything is Under Control. He says it in the foreword of that book. And that's basically like, you know, pretty much how Philip K. Dick utilized alien invasion as a trope in his fiction to cause anxiety in the reader. As I said, that hooks people in, right? It keeps you reading. Wilson used paranoia to accomplish the same thing. But so by using paranoia, there's something so interesting there because, you know, an alien invasion is an external force invading on you. Paranoia is coming from the inside. So, you know, you could be in the Illuminati and not even know it, right? James Jesus Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence chief, who was known as like the most paranoid guy in Washington, which must say a lot. He, at one point, he was always searching for a Soviet mole, but at one point he thought maybe he was the Soviet mole, you know, sort of a la Philip K. Dick, Scanner Darkly, if you will. And so just, you know, this is another element to Wilson is able to put this in his writing, like to provide this sort of, you know, context and this critical analysis that when you were, say, going through the shelves of Borders books back in the day and they had a conspiracy theory section, many other writers in that section would not be doing this. They're just sticking to one theory and that's the theory. And they'll spend 300 plus pages just hitting you over the head with this theory. Wilson is able to, through the skill of his writing, able to present all these different theories and then utilize conspiracy theories as basically critical thinking exercises that, you know, if you really look at, you know, what they're saying in the book, it's like, wait a minute, these are contradictory. So then how is this like this? And right there, he believes he's accomplishing his mission as a philosopher, which is to provoke thought. You know, that's the point of his writing, he believed.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also seems to me that there's, when we attribute things to conspiracies, we're kind of abandoning our own agency. And I think that, you know, not just with critical thinking, I see that he had a lot to say about stupidity. He saw stupidity as a major problem in the world. And so I appreciate the emphasis on critical thinking, but it also seems that he wants us to be agents of our own lives.
For sure. Yeah. That's a great point. You know, Wilson was pretty much, you know, this generation of American existentialists, if you will, this post-World War II generation. You know, for him in particular, he was, you know, born in 1932. So he was still very young when, you know, America dropped two atomic bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, killing nearly 200,000 people in 2 days, right? And then the fact that that has went quickly down the memory hole of America, and that there are not many memorial days for Nagasaki and Hiroshima in America, says a lot. And Wilson very early on he saw this, and he saw the human destruction of that, and he thought it was completely pointless. If that's how you win a war, what's the point of even fighting to begin with, if you will? But of course, what's the point of ending a war like that? So being forced to look at these things, this darkness of the human psyche, that's, you know, that's where existentialism was born out of, this, you know, these two world wars that just humans thought we were so great up until these two things. And then we saw just how like disgusting humans could be to each other. And, you know, instead of just becoming a pure nihilist, Wilson took the path through Chapel Perilous, if you will, and relied on his knowledge of science and found that there were parallels between, you know, the notion of operationalism and existentialism, right? That, in other words, that it's much harder to see things as they really are, if you will, you know, to see the infinite in everything than to just, you know, put your blinders on and just convince yourself that that's the way the universe is. It's actually easier to do that, you know, to be miserable than to remain open to the anticipation of every moment, you know? And yeah, Wilson's very important for that reason. I think that it comes through his writing, but this is, I mean, these are in books like Prometheus Rising and Quantum Psychology and whatnot. And, you know, where I settle in the book, if I have to place Bob in a philosophical camp and whatnot, you know, he's presenting a process philosophy, you know, and like just same but different as Heraclitus. You know, things are constantly in flux, and you know, there are things that work right now that are not going to work in the future. So we have to stay as attentive and aware as possible to the present moment.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to go back to Chapel Perilous, but I also want to stick to this line of inquiry for a little bit. One of the things I appreciate is that I would also put him in with the school of skeptics, true skepticism in the sense that, and he liked to play with that. He liked to play with our certainties about things. And I can't repeat how he would say it, but it was always to kind of question everything that, you know, some things are true from some perspective, some things are false from some perspective, and that we should engage in this constant sort of inquiry. And it seems to me that that's intellectually honest, but I can also imagine it's a how people might be uncomfortable with that because we like certainty. And it seems like he had this embrace of uncertainty and that certainty could lead us to, I don't necessarily want to say atrocities, but they can lead us down the wrong path.
Oh, for sure. Well, it sort of all kind of ties into, you know, Wilson's sort of a fairly holographic writer that like, you know, everything he's saying is reflected in every bit of his work, but he's shining a different, you know, side of his work in every book and whatnot. But in terms of like, you know, touching on what you said about Discordianism, you know, there are three core principles of Discordianism, right? There's the aneuristic, which is, you know, the apparent order, and that's, say, epitomized by the Pentagon and whatnot. And then there's the aoristic, right, which is the apparent disorder. As of the two, but the third core principle, which is seen as the most important, is the rejection of both the apparent order and the apparent disorder, because both are human creations of, you know, a chaos that we cannot really even describe. I mean, this is negative theology. You know, this is what basically, you know, John of Ireland, the 9th century theologian, was saying and presented that they used to have this in Christianity, the negative theology side. Since Thomas Aquinas, they only brought in the sort of, you call it the positive theology, meaning God is this, God is that. But negative theology is saying we can, all the words we use, every language that we create, every image that we create to represent this God, this thing called God, is a failure because God is so immense and we just can't even comprehend it. And Wilson is a proponent of this sort of negative theology mixed with a Taoist bent that, you know, this sort of God, if you will, is these interacting non-simultaneous processes that are just moving through time. And we think we have an understanding of it through different physics and cosmologies and philosophies or whatever. But the constant reminder, right, and with Discordianism is like, you know, and it ties into a huge influence on Wilson, which was the work of Korzybski and, you know, the notion of general semantics, which is this, what the whole point of Korzybski's work is to seek to get people in touch with the silent level of experience, meaning this area that, you know, we're using words right now to describe these, you know, processes going on in our mind and body. And, you know, we're constantly closing the aperture and only putting in, you know, reflecting a small amount of light compared to what's really around us all the time. And I think Wilson's work is dedicated to just, you know, widening the aperture, and mm-hmm. and it's not, you know, blow the lens up and, you know, throw a bomb at it and blow the lens up and let all the light in, man, like the Joker and chaos and wild right. and crazy. No, Wilson's work is like, he's like a sensei. It's a measured, you know, sort of belt by belt, you know, initiation system, if you will, if you approach it like this, and it's all in his work, really. So this idea of skepticism, yeah, Wilson is a skeptic, and he really, really tries to be. He, of course, he doesn't always accomplish what he's trying to do, right? He's dedicated himself to this sort of ultra skepticism, which is called Zeteticism, you know, which was sort of reignited by this sociologist, I think named Mario Truzzi, who was an original member of the Committee for Scientific Investigations, the Claims of the Paranormal, or PSYCOP for short. And PSYCOP became a punching bag for Bob. This was his, like, this is, you know, everyone, this is where he did that too. And so, meaning he creates sort of a straw man out of PSYCOP himself. So does Wilson. However, PSYCOP is worthy of much criticism for how they treat sincere, you know, scientists and researchers and whatnot. Yeah. So, but, you know, according to Wilson, PSYCOP, you know, performs this, you know, displays this performative skepticism. You know, it's people like the amazing Randy and these yeah. people that, like, you know, are on the Johnny Carson show showing how people do magic tricks and, you know, always, you know, pulling a pin on the fun, you know, and you know, whatever. And of course, the work of these skeptics, too, are, I think, important. You know, it's important to that sort of, you know, Randy went at Geller and sought to, you know, skepticize what he was doing. That was very important. But what Bob was saying was, and he and some other people, that these sort of, you know, showbiz skeptics, if you will, these famous skeptics, they were not practicing true skepticism, you know, and so therefore they're not really skeptics. And Wilson is repping, you know, this true sort of skepticism. I mean, there's a history for this. There's a long, you know, philosophical history for this. Bob, of course, and I think he gets this from Truzzi, is invoking the work of, I think his name, Pyro of Elias, Elias, right? And yeah. and he's sort of the original Zeteticist. And that's basically, yeah, there's this history of academia, academic skeptics, and then those who are like, you know, we're the real skeptics. And this goes back to the days of ancient Greece and whatnot. And yeah, I put that in the book to really, you know, show a little historical perspective and context that this conversation has been going on for a very long time. And I think Wilson does a very fabulous job of illustrating his perspective. But I do think that it's definitely beneficial to especially people who never heard of Bob to present it the way I presented it in my book, Chapel Perilous, Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, because, you know, it's, I'm just putting it together piece by piece, how Wilson, like Voltron, built up his bodysuit of armor and went into Chapel Perilous and became an important figure for today, you know, because I think so many people are in these states of high uncertainty and they're rootless, they're rudderless. They don't have a system to help make sense of the world. And Wilson's system, if you will, is basically educate yourself. That's it. Educate yourself in philosophy, in science, and know, you know, how to read the news critically, you know how to read legal briefs, know the difference between an assertion and an argument, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, of course, one could stop at Illuminatus trilogy and then be like, yo, this guy is crazy, man. He started the Illuminati thing, you know, and there are actually some, I guess, well-reputed news outlets that somehow find that Illuminatus trilogy is the cause of today's current Illuminati, you know, thing. And it's like, no, it's far deeper than that. But yeah, I think Wilson throughout the course of his career really presents a very solid ontological and epistemological philosophy that was never really recognized in his life because he was just seen as this, you know, fringe countercult culture, underground newspaper, underground culture sort of, you know, writer. And, but, you know, he's been dead for, you know, 18 years now, and it's time to give him his props.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. And what I always like is that the sort of the anti-dogmatism, you know, and, you know, he talks a lot about the, his word for it is the reality tunnels. And I think that's very useful to recognize that we all are looking at things through our reality tunnels, and that may not necessarily be the way things are, and that we should begin questioning them. I like in the book you had at one point where he suggested, you know, that we should stop and ask ourselves, I think, you know, at least once a day, am I being a useful idiot for somebody?
That's a great question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also another one of his is you ask yourself, am I being a cosmic schmuck?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So there are two lines I want to go through. One is we've kind of talked about some of the influences. So I would like to kind of dig deeper into those, but also Chapel Perilous. What is Chapel Perilous? So maybe that would be the good place to start. And then we can kind of dig into some of the influences and how they helped form his ideas.
For sure. Yes. Chapel Perilous, for starters, is the name of my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson. It is a concept that was sort of first really used beginning in a 15th century poem by a writer named Thomas de Malory, I believe. And the poem was called The Death of Arthur. And in this poem, it's about the Arthurian mythos. So King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, the last of the sort of Celtic kings of England, present day England, before the Anglo-Saxons came in and took over. And the story follows a knight who must enter the chapel to retrieve a piece of cloth from a fallen knight in order to heal another knight along their path towards the Holy Grail, which, you know, is the chalice of, you know, ultimate wisdom and enlightenment, if you will, or according to Indiana Jones, eternal life. And so the Chapel Perilous in this Arthurian mythos, and of course that Arthurian mythos, you know, goes back for centuries before, and it's even, you know, rooted in, you know, myth, you know, Celtic myth of that, you know, that era. And it is, you know, really, it's a location, it's a physical space within the story. It's an actual chapel, and, you know, it's where horrible things happen, and you could lose your mind going inside. It's a pure horror house. And it, you know, shows that the knight must be like strong and resolute in order to get through and, you know, receive the cloth to heal others. When Wilson utilizes the term in the 1970s, you know, particularly in his book, Cosmic Trigger, Volume 1, Chapel Perilous is transformed in sort of a psychological, you know, space where the events of one's life and the outside world no longer seem to be, you know, originating from a rational source. Reason seems to no longer prevail. And supernatural forces and the idea of magic seems, you know, more of an explanation, you know, more of a plausible explanation than even, you know, simple A-B causality. And of course, what aided Wilson in this entering the psychological space was his immersion into doing a lot of hallucinogens, studying Jungian psychology deeply, moving around a whole lot, being, you know, totally uprooted for a number of years, you know, adding like extra intensity to his everyday life. And then the biggest influence during that time was his work with thelemic magic, the work of Aleister Crowley, but not just thelemic magic, but, you know, a wider exploration of the Western esoteric tradition. So, you know, Wilson, you know, studied the work of Israel Regardi and the Golden Dawn system and, you know, yoga and other things. And then what really, you know, delineates this space for Wilson, he really makes it his own. You know, this term really now, I think, is, other people have used it, other writers have used the term, but it's mostly associated with Robert Anton Wilson. That's what most people would, if they know about it, they would know it, you know, in relation to him and his work. And he, you know, basically uses the term as like a, you know, it's part of his journey through this sort of self-initiation through a magical worldview where he's increased his capacity for intuition and his openness to, you know, magic in the world. And not just like, oh, isn't that sunset magical? But I did this ritual, this money magic ritual, because this publisher owes me money and he's 6 weeks late on paying me my money that he owes me. Like, what can I do? I can't do anything else in the outside world. I'll do this magical ritual. And Wilson writes about how he got paid like the next day and things like that. So it's like, that's what the chaos magicians would call results magic, right? And Wilson just has, again, this fantastic, wonderful, philosophical, like, wide mind. So he's, as he's journeying through Chapel Perilous and, you know, going deep on the initiatory, you know, studying the Crowleyan curriculum, which there is a series of grades and things that one must do. And he's doing these things step by step, for instance, a magical diary and a dream diary, et cetera, et cetera. Wilson is just presenting these really nice historical anthropological explorations of what magic is and what it means in our present world, to the fact that many people who have gotten into like the work of Aleister Crowley, say according to Alan Moore, was mostly through Robert Anton Wilson first. Like, Wilson is the introducer to Crowley's work, and I could testify to the same effect. I would have never probably heard of Aleister Crowley if not reading for Robert Anton Wilson, you know? So, yeah. So really long answer to your question. He's very important.
Yeah. Well, he is what I probably heard of Crowley before, but he's the one that I think made me think about him differently. I think that there's a lot of negativity, you know, he's the beast, you know, people like, you know, he's evil, stay away. And I think it was Wilson who was recommending, you know, book four as a work of consciousness, of how to transform your consciousness. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Maybe I should look at this then.
For sure. I think that's what Wilson is able to do for Crowley in that regard, because yeah. I really would have probably had no interest, as I said. And then it was that same exact sort of sentiment, Wilson talking about exactly book four and the idea of, you know, working with and studying your consciousness. And that's part of his path through Chapel Perilous, right? And then, you know, sort of his, at least by the end of Cosmic Trigger Volume 1, like the knowledge he has to pass on to people, that like when you travel through Chapel Perilous, you could either become like a mega paranoid or sort of model agnostic, you know, less easily sucked into a wild train of thought that like mega jumbo conspiracy theories that can, you know, that will bring to your life, you know? So yeah. And his ability, as I said, just to present the work of Crowley and probably give it the best reflection that there is. Cause I mean, learning about Crowley independently of Wilson, I mean, there are things that he did that I find pretty disgusting. And I think he was fairly racist and not really cool to Irish people either. And like, he sounded like a dickhead really. And, but Bob is able to just say, yeah, that's true. That's true. But let's, you know, look at his work.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And that's the approach I always take. It's like, well, I don't think he was evil, but he was an ass.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because I never actually knew the connection with Wilson and chaos magic. And that's something that you noted in the book, is that Wilson was deeply influential to the development of chaos magic.
He's influential. He's definitely influential. The kind of chaos magic scene that emerges in the 70s and 80s in the UK, you know, people like Phil Hine, Peter Carroll, and I'm forgetting his first name, Sneed. And that's a pseudonym. Sherwin, Ray Sherwin, I believe. I think that's his name. Those three individuals. And then of course the scene that emerges around them. And then also I would say Genesis Peorage is kind of floating around there as Temple of Psychic Youth stuff. Right. Is going on concurrently, and you know, Peorage is heavily influenced by Burroughs, and I would say Peorage has an influence too on the chaos magic guys, but I think the biggest influence is probably Austin Osman's Spar, or however you say his name, and you know, this person who really presented the sigil as this tool for magic. And I would say chaos magic is probably most known for this, utilizing sigils, which is, you know, you write out a desire and you cross out all the repeating letters and you cross out all the vowels. And then with the remaining letters, you create a talisman, and then you study that talisman, and then you destroy it and you completely forget about it. But then you do like a highly charged, you know, thing. And of course, my introduction to chaos magic was through the Invisibles and Grant Morrison's work.
Right.
And, you know, hearing how he charged sigils, and, you know, for him, he, you know, the book, the comic book, The Invisibles, was a hyper sigil. And my book, Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson, is a hyper sigil. Like, this is a magical object, just like the work of Wilson's. Like, and so, but Wilson's influence on the chaos magic scene is his, I'd say, model agnosticism, especially towards the notion of belief, like the knowledge of how belief works for people. And, you know, even just studying, like, well, what is belief, right? Like, because if one is, you know, well, just examining the notion, you know, again, like, yes, as I just said, of belief. So if one is an essentialist about things, you know, your belief might be tied to just one view of the world, because that's essentially how things are. But if things are constantly moving and you're sort of an existentialist and you're seeing that you're moving in different networks and groups, it's like, okay, this is the reflection of the world in this group here moving along. And then this is the belief here. So viewing beliefs is like these sort of game rules, right? So Wilson, as, you know, really examining the idea of belief, is what is a big influence on the chaos magic scene, I would say. So he's one of a number of influences that include Burroughs, Austin Spar, Aleister Crowley, although they don't, I don't know. I guess Crowley's not really, anyway, Aleister Crowley. I think some of them, like Peter Carroll, they're not really into thelemic magic. It's right. More like contemplative. It's not results magic. But yeah, so yeah, Bob had an influence for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting just to the circles he is involved in, you know, with the magic Crowley and then William S. Burroughs, and he knew Burroughs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Let's talk about some of his other influences. You've mentioned, I never know if I'm pronouncing this right, the Orzabowski, the general semantics. And I know that James Joyce was a huge influence on Bob. Who were some of his other major influences?
Yeah, so Korzybski, I think, is his major sort of philosophical influence, the notion of general semantics, and the awareness that there's, you know, everyone has a unique perspective that needs to be heard. We'll just say it like that. Yeah. There are someone like Ezra Pound, who was an influence on sort of like this eclecticism. So Wilson learned about a number of different, say, economists through Pound, people like Silvio Gesell, who you know, created like the sort of alternative currency that was very successful, that was used in Germany. It was called velocity money. It would lose value if you held on to the money, so it had to constantly circulate, right? And so Bob was into these sort of things, and I think he sort of got a little bit of that from Ezra Pound. But I think Wilson was already sort of an eclectic, you know, mind to begin with. So high school was an extremely formative time for him. He, you know, as I said, was, you know, he was sort of born and raised in the South Shores of Brooklyn, a sort of Irish ghetto, depressed environment. There was not a lot of intellectual happenings. And then he goes to Brooklyn Tech for high school, which is still one of the most illustrious sort of science high schools in the country. He passed a, you know, very difficult test to gain entry there. And it's there that he, like, his mind just opens, cracks open, and he just reads everything, it seems like. You know, he reads Korzybski in 1948 at the age of 16, a big giant 800-page book, you know, in a weekend, he says. He reads Claude Shannon's Theory of Communication paper, also published in 1948. So he reads all this cutting-edge science material as it's coming out, and then spends the rest of his career sort of synthesizing all these different systems, you know, that seem very disparate and disconnected from one another, you know, very eclectic, but, you know, presents it in his own unique way that he's able to really teach the readers about what's going on, say, in like quantum entanglement and, you know, how to break things down easily. So for those who, say, fell asleep in physics class their senior year, you know, here comes Bob to the rescue, you know. So, yeah, there's these three major sort of influences from his early life. James Joyce, of course, being a major literary influence. And Joyce is an experimentalist like par excellence. So Wilson's work is always experimental in the sense that he never writes the same type of novel twice. You know, the format and style and structure of Illuminatus is very different than that of Schrodinger's Cat and then that of The Widow's Son. And he's always, you know, playing around and doing really fun stuff. And so I just lost the train of thought, bro. What was that?
That's okay. Well, we were just talking about some of his influences.
Oh, influences, of course. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, and then so he remains open for the rest of his life. So he, Tim Leary becomes a major influence, but he doesn't discover Tim Leary until 1964 at the age of 32. So he's humble enough to, you know, let another, you know, contemporary be a major influence on him. But Leary is an influence because Leary also, you know, is simpatico with the way that he was already thinking too. They have similar influences themselves. Like Leary was a huge, giant fan of James Joyce, and they were both very aware of game theory, and Bob, again, was very aware of physics. So I think there were just two sharp minds that sort of became a, you know, a gruesome twosome out there, you know, dynamic duo. And James Frazier, the author of The Golden Bow, sort of like The Golden Bow and all those different volumes, kind of seen as the birth of comparative religions, if you will. So, you know, Frazier's a big influence, and he reads a lot of him, enough to the fact that when he meets Joseph Campbell around 1959 at a party, you know, he's able to hold his own with like the world-renowned, you know, comparative religious guy. There's a little known book called by, I think it was Philip Wiley, called Essay on Morals, I believe. And that book sort of presents Jung's, what is it, personality theory, I guess, that there's four, you know, sort of aspects to human personality, you know, rational, intuitive, emotional, sensual. And Wilson, very young, he determines that he's mostly like a rational sort of mind, and he wants then to develop these other parts of his self, right? So this coincides with basically Jungian psychology, that we have to seek this individuation, this synthesis, this, you know, the center of the cyclone, this, you know. And Leary's work is similar, really. You know, Leary's known for just being the wild acid guy, but he and his team were the creator of this thing called the Leary Circumplex, which was a personality theory test, and it's 64 different variations of like a human personality, and the goal is to be able to like experience all these different aspects of yourself and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, so Bob is very in tune with like the current science of the time, and always trying to break it down in as simple language as possible, I guess. And one influence for that approach is Friedrich Nietzsche. You know, Wilson loved Nietzsche as a linguistic philosopher more than anything else. He sort of hated Nietzsche's Superman theory. He thought that was like total BS, but he saw in Nietzsche this real, you know, like, of course, like this hyper focus on everything. Yeah. And he found Nietzsche liberating. I mean, when Wilson suffered one of his many bouts of major depression, you know, he writes to his friend Greg Hill about what got him out was LSD, marijuana, and Nietzsche, right? Mm. And just this notion of just like, you know, your art is your life vest. You, this will get you through, man. Your song, your art will get you through this whatever this is, right? This pain that you're going through. And so he's just such an open mind, and he's continuing to take in influences. Discordianism was a major influence, of course. He didn't create Discordianism. That was Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley. But he gets so enthusiastic about things that, you know, he, as Peter Carroll said, you know, one of the founders of Chaos Magic, that Bob had like this jet engine mind, and he just took all these different, you know, huge wedges of information and the exhaust of it, of just the mind working, it was his amazing line of conversation that brought in all these different things. And all his influences are always there. Karl Popper, a scientific philosopher, was a big influence. Popper, you know, created the notion of the theory of falsifiability, which is that there's just some things that can't be tested scientifically. So to say it is completely meaningless. So to argue about the existence of God, or, you know, whose God is better, is totally pointless. And right. If we really look at things, we see that religious wars at the root of it are really about resources when we really look at things, right? And George Carlin is a huge influence on him, and he's a huge influence on George Carlin. Yeah. George Carlin is one of his earliest fans. George Carlin reads his work in like 1959 in the early 60s, and is totally inspired by this guy. George Carlin once said, "I learned more from the work of Robert Anton Wilson than any other source." I mean, that's such a quote. That's the greatest stand-up of all time, as far as I'm concerned, giving you the ultimate cosign. So Marshall McLuhan is a major influence as well. It really, he's like a library. Bob is like a search engine, right? Like and that's why, like in my book, you know, there's plenty of other people that I have not really mentioned. Maybe I'll just leave it with one more. Of course, Burroughs is an influence in terms of the way that he stylistically writes, but there's someone like Madeline Murray O'Hare, who was, she's forgotten now really, but she was sort of a big media personality in the 70s and 80s, 60s even. She was most known for successfully suing the public school system of America to get them to stop saying morning prayer, because America is not a religious country. The founding fathers were not Christian. They, you know, there's the theory, the Treaty of Tripoli, I believe, or we won't go down that engine hole. But so she was adamant about this. She was an adamant atheist, and Wilson was friends with her in the mid 60s. And he wrote about her for, you know, a magazine he was writing for. And then she, after his article came out, Time Magazine and Life Magazine followed. And she then became even more famous, and they even used it was either Time or Life. They used the same exact title that Bob used. They ripped off his title from his article for their own article, right? And the most hated woman in America. And that became then like her tagline, if you will. So Bob was influenced by those who were long dead, to, you know, artists who were creating when he was a kid, from Orson Welles, another major influence. And then his contemporaries. He allowed himself to be a fan of contemporaries, you know, and he, leaving it on this, like, he, one nice note about him is he was never shy of attribution. He presented these great ideas, but he was always clear on, like, yeah, this whole 23 enigma, this is from William S. Burroughs, right? And this eight circuit model of intelligence thing that I have like really developed and made into this. He didn't even say that, but he's like, this is from Tim Leary. But I've read the original transcript of the, you know, where that comes from. I went to the New York Public Library and looked at it. Like, Wilson is, in my mind, a co-creator of that eight circuit model of intelligence, even though he was so humble, you know, because Leary was the one that came up with it. But so in other words, you know, Bob is not afraid to be influenced. And then he's a constant influence. Like, he was influencing George Carlin. That's, you know, should be said enough. And so, yeah. And there are other, you know, more arcane influences, Giambattista Vico, you know, Giordano Bruno. But yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting that, because I can see this, when you were talking about Tim Leary, that the influence of Leary on Wilson, but I was thinking, you know, I'm like, but I think that Wilson was an influence on him too. And I saw it as, you know, kind of a mutual thing. And I think that so many of the people that were brought up, I mean, in his circle were like that. And that's one of the reasons why it's so interesting that he's not better known. It's a shame. Really, it's a shame. Is there any other reasons that you can think of as to why he is the most important writer that we haven't heard about?
Oh, I mean, the Illuminati, man. It's a conspiracy.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. Forgot about that. How could I forget?
Well, maybe I'm not quite totally sure. Well, you know, Wilson had always, he like daydreamed. He really hoped that Illuminatus trilogy would be made into a movie.
Yeah.
He thought the filmmaker Costas would be he's sort of like not well known these days, but sort of very well known political sort of movie maker. And they've tried over the years to make that a TV show. His influence in UK cultures is almost even more pronounced because an actor, director who was also kind of, you know, an underground legend in England named Ken Campbell was able to pull off the near impossible and make Illuminatus a super long play. And Ken Campbell, I write about him in my book a little bit, like he's a, you know, there were another influence on Bob, and they were kindred spirits. And Campbell found Illuminatus trilogy at a bookstore in the same magical way. He saw the cover of Illuminatus and it called to him, you know, just as he got the deal to create a play, Ken Campbell was like, well, what am I going to make it on? You know, what am I going to base it on? He wanted to adapt something. And then he saw Illuminatus, and that became a whole magical culture in the UK because that play, first of all, the actors that were involved in that play in the National Theatre when it premiered in 1977, I mean, they went on to be huge British film actors. You know, the great Bill Broadbent, who was absolutely hilarious. Chris Nahi, I believe, I'm going to mispronounce his name, also hilarious. He was in Shaun of the Dead. Bill Broadbent was in Hot Fuzz and a bunch of other stuff, Perrier's Bounty. Really great actors, really fun actors. And of course, Ken Campbell and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, there was a man named Bill Drummond who was involved in that stage production and another guy named Jimmy Caudy who was watching that stage production from the crowd. And those two guys later formed this group called KLF. And the KLF became a major sort of legendary rock group out in like the UK, not rock group, but just musical, you know, group, art group, you know, and they're still going strong today. And my point being is that Illuminatus got deeper into the sort of like, you know, countercultural mind of the UK out there at the time. And again, remains so to this day. In America, it was picked up on, you know, by different styles of fringe and whatnot for many years, because Illuminatus is one of those books that really, you know, booksellers are selling it on the corner, right? Like, it's a word of mouth book that people get, and that's adds to its magic, you know. And but so perhaps it's the fact that Illuminatus was never really totally, you know, made into like a movie or a show or some sort in America. And then, you know, things that Bob talks about and really puts his own spin on, like even the notion of Chapel Perilous, like that's not his own creation, right? Mm-hmm. But he puts his own spin on it. The 23 Enigma, that's not his own creation. He puts his own spin on it. You know, he thought it was Burroughs's sort of like real experience, but as I show in my book and detail in my book, the, you know, Jack Kirby had written about this weird 23 cursed enigma before even Burroughs told Wilson about the 23 Enigma. So in other words, and when Wilson writes sort of novels, they're sort of pastiche, right? Mm. They're meaning they're, his influences are very apparent, right? So The Widow's Son, which is such a fantastic historical novel, utilizes all these ridiculous footnotes that sometimes take up half to three quarters of the page. And they're absolutely hilarious. But that's a pure influence from this Irish writer, Brian O'Nolan, who was known as Flann O'Brien, whose book, Third Policeman, has these huge, ridiculous, you know, long footnotes. So, but yeah, so Bob's playing with all these tropes. So in other words, it's very easy if you wanted to just avoid paying Wilson or his trust or whatever money to develop his idea in particular, to just extricate certain things. Cause what, you know, what was his to begin with? And then lastly, he got a bit prickly around, you know, they made an Illuminati card game in 1978, this guy named Steve Jackson. And, you know, Robert Shea was very on board with it, but Wilson was prickly in terms of the rights and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So maybe he was a bit guarded about his work too. So these sorts of things, I think, added to maybe his not being, you know, too well known. But also, I just think it's time. As he said, it's steam engines when it's steam engine time. I think the culture is ready now to learn about who Robert Anton Wilson was, because part of what's great about him is his story and how he lived his life, how he lived as an artist and a freelance writer in late 20th century America. There's real value in that, you know, like,
Yeah, I'm looking for a quote here. So let me see here. As I explained to you, I'll say this to the, here we go. I found it. Whenever I interview someone, I go through their books. I always make a point of reading everyone's book, and I will have notes from the book, usually passages of the book. And typically I'll have like 2 pages, maybe 3 or 4. I have 9 pages here. So, but to the, what you just said, this is the quote. He believed the emotional plague, which keeps people from experiencing spontaneous life, emotions, and pleasure, has created the toxic environment from which all warfare has emerged. It does so because, in the absence of feeling joy, the emotional plague fills people with a murderous rage that finds expression through authoritarian strongmen.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked that quote because it speaks to a lot of where I come from. And, you know, Wilson's been an influence on me, but what I would think of is, you know, I'm always quoting Henry David Thoreau and Walden, where he talks about, you know, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. And I always kind of equate that there's this, we're kind of creative individuals. We have this power to create and to be and to be free, but yet we're not. And it's kind of like the systems that keep us in check and keep us down. And I see Wilson as really challenging those systems. And here, you know, he's calling it, you know, authoritarian, and it doesn't have to even be authoritarian. You know, I think that, you know, the history of our corporatocracies and whatnot kind of veer on authoritarianism there. But it seems to me it's that, for me, that's what spirituality is that sense of the spontaneity of life and feeling connected to it, being present to our own lives. And he seems to want us to do that. And I think that the way that we do that is by questioning and educating ourselves. And I love the idea that educating ourselves is a rebellious act.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, As Alexander Pope said, I believe, a little learning is a dangerous thing.
Yeah. So I know we're kind of running out of time here, but let me ask you, you think that this is the time for Bob? I hope so. I imagine that the Illuminatus is still in print. I would hope his other books are still in print as well. The thing that I always, and I think maybe this might be a good place to end, is one of the things that appeals to me so much about Wilson is that he is such an optimist. And you had mentioned that he had suffered from depression. His family life was challenging. His daughter was murdered. His son had schizophrenia. But yet he always seemed to maintain an optimism through all of that. And it seems to me that that's one of the other great things that we can take from him and his work, is to be optimistic about our future and where we're heading, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, he really held on. He held strong to the, I guess, the approach of optimism. And, you know, it wasn't Pollyanna-ish. It was, he was able to look at the, you know, the terror or the horror of the situation. You know, he looked into the abyss. He fought monsters and managed not to become one himself. And that was because he you know, was an avowed optimist. It was a conscious choice. He used to often, you know, reference a scientific study that said optimists live longer. And I would say that it helped him live a better life. I mean, he never was healed of polio. He never received the polio vaccine when he contracted it in 1934. That was years before the vaccine was created. So he managed the symptoms of polio through this thing called the Sister Kenny method. And, you know, what he found is, you know, there's that one phrase, like, there's no atheists in a foxhole. Well, you can't be fatalistic in a foxhole either. You want to die? Because that's where Bob's coming from. Like, he's not hanging in some, you know, cushy chair in some, you know, cloistered library somewhere. And, you know, he's out there on the street, and he understands that, like, optimism is a tool. It gives you strength. You have to be optimistic or else you're going to die. Like, that's, yeah. I think that's where it's rooted from with him, you know? So I see a lot of value in that.
All right. So that was kind of like where I was with his thinking and his philosophy and his writing. As we end, is there anything that you would like to add in terms of his thought and what he has contributed that maybe we didn't get to, that you think is important for people who don't necessarily know who Wilson is, and that might kind of prod them a little bit more to investigate him?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, for one, I think if you're a fan of George Carlin, or if you have any type of sense of humor, I think that you'll enjoy the work of Robert Anton Wilson to begin with. I think he's funny AF, you know, and he's goofy. He's, you know, as this Robert Anton Wilson scholar, Michael Johnson, called Bob, he's a stoner intellectual. You know, he writes for stoner intellectuals. So, but in terms of, you know, kind of philosophical, you know, value that he brings, man, this allegiance this to model agnosticism, you know, what he calls model agnosticism, which is basically don't totally buy in emotionally to every, don't believe everything you think.
Right.
You know, simply put. And then don't believe everything everyone tells you completely. But that's not to say be some strange paranoid solipsistic, you know, contrarian, right? But just be aware that we're flawed people. And, you know, as Korzybski said, you know, whatever we say it is, it isn't. Because it all comes back to that notion that, like, this experience is so wide and grand, you know, we have to constantly humble ourselves to the fact that, you know, our maps are not the territory for everything. And the same goes for everyone else, which means that, so what Wilson says, we have to listen to everyone, but everyone has to listen to us. Yet you have to know when someone's either, you know, a crazy cult leader or like full of shit, because you got to know when to leave as well, you know? So I think Wilson's, again, this is encapsulated nicely in this allegiance to model agnosticism and, you know, seeking to really get clear on critical thinking skills. you know, and people wouldn't normally associate that with Wilson, but I think it comes down to, you know, intelligence increase, you know, educate yourself as much as possible, learn how to fix a car and learn quantum mechanics, learn how to cook a meal and learn how to build a house, like all these sorts of things.
Yeah. I've spent 20 years teaching critical thinking, and I actually have introduced a few things of Wilson into my classes, not necessarily in the readings, but some of the ideas, especially the idea that, you know, don't necessarily believe everything that you think is true and don't necessarily believe what someone else says is necessarily true, but to question that and also to be mindful of the way we word things. I know I got this from him, and it's the, I know he was a proponent. He wrote some of his books in that E prime, which is where he got rid of the verb is. And I started doing that myself instead of, you know, saying, oh, well, this person is that or that. You know, I was always saying, well, in my opinion, rather than making a kind of ontological statement about their character.
Right. Yeah. That awareness of, as someone once called it, the tyranny of words.
Yeah. Yeah. Very early class, I was talking about language creating reality, and students were really interested in that. They wanted to know how. So, Gabriel, I really appreciate your time. We could talk a lot more about Bob, I think. Let me ask you one final question. You interviewed him in 2003.
I did.
What was it like? What was it like to meet the man and to talk with him?
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, it was really great. I felt for after that, you know, the phrase, you know, never meet your heroes or whatever. But at the time, he was my hero, and I met him and I thought he was really, really great. And I was extremely happy, you know, leaving the condominium place that he was living at in Capitola at the time. And I was extremely nervous interviewing him. You know, I was sort of traveling around a bit. I had come up from Mexico specifically to go to Santa Cruz to see the premiere of the documentary based on him. It was called Maybe Logic. And that premiered on July 23rd, 2003. And so I was staying at a youth hostel, and it was a very strange, it was the weirdest youth hostel I've ever stayed in my life. Like, they basically kicked you out at 10 in the morning until like 6 p.m. And then they locked all the doors at like 10 p.m. So if you left at 10, you couldn't get back in. So I figured out a way how to sneak out of that youth hostel and then sneak back in and stuff. And I saw the movie, and through David J. Brown, who you've interviewed, he made the connection for me to, he told Bob about me. And then the next day I received an email from someone named Mark at Cruzio.net or something like that. And he was like, hey, I'm Bob, you know, this is my address, come on by. And that was the only time I'd ever been in Santa Cruz. So I was like, oh, wow. What am I going to do? So I took a bus to Radio Shack, and I bought like an old style Radio Shack, little microphone, cassette player, recorder. And then I took the bus to Capitola, and clear memories, very clear memories. I was so excited. I was like, holy shit. Like, I'm going to sit down and talk with Bob. He was in a wheelchair at that time, mostly because he had post polio syndrome or sequelae. So the polio had come back, yet he greeted me at his door standing up. And I think he had a walker. I believe he did. And, you know, he was a bit wobbly on his feet, and I was like, Hey, what's up? And, you know, he walked me inside, and I was struck by the fact that his small apartment was like, there was like no books. And I was like expecting like, you know, a library of like esoteric lore. And he sat down, and before he sat down, he's like, I like to walk around, you know, to keep my legs moving. But sometimes, you know, I like to greet guests standing up, but I'll walk around my friends, but then I'll fall and just kind of embarrass everyone. And like, I just kind of awkwardly laugh like, ha. And then he sat and he offered me some Jameson, and I still wish I drank Jameson with Bob. I was far too nervous though, because I didn't have any questions prepared. It was all just from years of studying his work and just like really studying his work. And so just press record and hung out with him for like 2 hours interviewing him. And he was very kind of weak then. So his voice was sort of, you know, faint in a way, not that baritone. But, you know, I could hear him. It was just hard picking up to transcribe later on. It took me months to transcribe that interview. And that interview really became, you know, the spiritual seed of this book, right? Like, here it was. It's the first interview for Chapel Perilous, The Life and Thought Crimes of Robert Anton Wilson that I did, right?
Right.
And it was awesome. I was like, this guy's the best. And he was like a, you know, funny grandpa, because like at the end, near the end, he farted. You know what I mean? And I was like, what? And he was just like, oh, you heard that? And I was like, and then he told the story about like a Mark Twain short story or something, where all these different characters from these different times, and they speak in different ways, like Victorian English or, you know, Shakespearean or whatever, but someone's sitting around the table, it's a fancy table, and then someone farts, and then everyone's describing the sound of the fart in the different tones and languages, and which ties in two influences on Wilson, I think, and they need to be mentioned. Mark Twain, of course. Wilson is completely in the school of American humor, Mark Twain, 100%. Yeah. And then also Shakespeare. Shakespeare was a huge influence on Bob. So, yeah, man. And then that interview was fantastic. It was great. And then he lived for a few more years, and he started this thing called the Maybe Logic Academy, which was an online remote learning asynchronous website, which is the same exact sort of model as universities use today for asynchronous remote learning, minus the Zoom meetings or whatever. And Bob taught there for the last 3 years of his life. And it was there where it was like grad school, really. Like the amount of intelligent people that were on that website, there's been no interaction with the internet that has ever been as amazing as that. Like that was like a grad school. Like people who went there will tell you, it was just like people were totally doing their own thing, like heavy research of things influenced by Wilson and then sharing it with each other. So I learned a tremendous amount there. And that interview was great. That interview was great.
Yeah. 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 I remember the Maybe Logic Academy. I kept eyeing it at the time, and I don't know why I didn't join up. Probably due to time. I was going back to school at that time, and I kind of regret that decision. So let me ask you, it took you a long time to write this book. It's very well researched and incredibly well written. And like I had mentioned, you know, towards the end, I kind of teared up a little bit, which I think I see that as a compliment to you, that you made Bob such a presence. You know, I felt like I got to know him in ways that I hadn't before. But what are you doing now? What's next for you?
That's a great question. I'm continuing to sort of put, you know, further contextualize the book and present the book through my website, chapelperilous.us. It's also there that people can purchase the book. There's so much I put in the book that I could just, you know, unpack, and that will just take a long time to unpack like specific sections. So I'm doing that via the website and my articles on medium.com and Substack as well right now. So sort of further, you know, fleshing out and letting unpacking this, you know, this book, because I really, during that time, almost half of that time for writing the book was like editing the book and just compressing as much as I possibly could but present it in as smooth a way as possible. I wanted to create something inexhaustible, because that's what Wilson's work is to me. And Wilson loved inexhaustible art himself, you know? And so I have a few other sort of, I guess, books, pamphlets in the works around sort of Wilson's thought, you know, his philosophy. And I was thinking of perhaps putting together sort of like a book of the interviews, the raw interviews that I didn't get to kind of put in, with sort of the behind the scenes. So, you know, provide some stories as to why it took so long to write this book, you know, the sort of magical adventure that occurred while writing it. Yeah. And so, you know, I have a few other things, I guess, on the back burner, but I really want to honor this book and give it its full shine right now, because I self-published it. It's really only available on the internet right now. It's not in, it's only in one bookstore in America. Shout out to Driftless Books in Wisconsin, Eddie Nix. I want to get into further bookstores, but it's been a really do-it-yourself independent project through and through. I mean, the book cover itself was designed by my girlfriend, the Semiotic Alchemist, you know, like even, you know, buying the barcode and constructing absolutely everything, the things that the publisher would generally take care of. So I think that it needs time. I want to just show this book off for, for some time, maybe for the next year still, you know?
So would it help if people who are interested in the book went to their local bookstore and said, hey, can you order this for me?
Yeah, I think it definitely would help. Yeah. There's some technical stuff about like being in the Ingram Spark database and all this sort of thing and things that I have to look further into. It's not really like, you know, what I got into writing for.
Right.
But yeah, but that would be great. I mean, you know, the more people talking about it, of course, would be. It'd be fantastic. And the people who have talked about it thus far have been very, you know, laudatory. So that's very, very nice.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, and I'm not saying this just because I'm talking to you. It was a really good book. It was a really good read, and I thought it was very well written and very much appreciated. And because I've been wondering with a couple of people that have been influential for me, one specifically was Wilson. It's like, well, where are the books about Wilson and his contributions? And so I think it's incredibly valuable, and I hope that it will help keep Bob's memory and his thinking alive.
I think so. Definitely.
Yeah. Me too. Well, Gabriel, again, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciated it. I appreciated the conversation. There are, I'm sure, other areas we could have gone, but I want to keep this kind of compact as much as possible for the listeners and viewers.
Sure. Just to leave on the note that, you know, Wilson presented so many ideas, right? Yeah. And I really made sure to present the person in this book and to really get the true visceral feel of what is it like. If you want to be an artist, if you want to walk your own path in this life, read this book.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. That's a very good point. It wasn't necessarily easy for him. There was certainly some like financial struggles along with the personal struggles, but he persevered. And, you know, one of the things I love about Bob Wilson is that you can watch videos and listen to recordings of him. He really takes these ideas and he makes them very presentable. He's like the everyman philosopher.
Heck yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Gabriel, again, thank you. And I hope that the book is a resounding success for you. It deserves to be.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate that. And thank you for having me on here today.
And that's a wrap on episode 192 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I put a lot of effort and time into each episode. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with the equipment, hosting, other necessary subscriptions and costs would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to support my work. As always, I like to say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.